Section, Judge Ross, Judge Rogelmeyer, Judge Ratfold, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning. And please be seated. Welcome to this October 23rd panel of the Court of Appeals. We have six cases on our calendar today, three of which are orally presented and two non-oral cases. Our volume's a little loud. There. Better? First case on for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota versus Hassan Muse. I'm assuming that's right. Is it Muse or Muse? Muzi. Okay. I'll try to remember that. Minnesota v. Muzi. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 for appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please be mindful of the timing limitations. They are indicated in the light and the clock that's in your podium, which you can elevate or lower to your height at your convenience. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. And you may proceed.
Attorney William Coughlin, representing Hassan Muzi, along with Attorney Gary Wolf.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Coughlin. And you have the floor whenever you'd like to proceed.
May I begin, Your Honor?
You certainly may.
May it please the Court, my name is Attorney William J. Coughlin, and I, along with Attorney Gary Wolf, represent Hassan Muzi in this appeal. We raised 5 issues on appeal, and I will briefly address each issue. Our first argument, Hassan Muzi's constitutional right to a speedy trial was violated, and as such, this case should be dismissed with prejudice. I'm first going to start out by listing all the factors that are not in dispute on that issue, which is almost all of them. There's no dispute that the U.S. Constitution and the Minnesota Constitution guarantee the right to a speedy trial. There's no dispute on this issue that it is subject to de novo review. There is no dispute that if asserted earlier in writing as to speedy trial under Minnesota law, the trial shall commence within 60 days of that request. There's no dispute that if asserted, a delay longer than 60 days is presumptively prejudicial to the defendant.
Mr. Coughlin, can I jump you to one
Yes.
part of that argument? I'm curious, in your research, what did you find to be the shortest delay that led to a reversal based upon speedy trial?
I don't recall, Your Honor, as to that issue.
Do you recall?
It's just that any delay triggers the
right.
The
I understand about the triggering. I mean about the ultimate analysis after going through all the factors. Were you able to find a case anywhere where an appellate court, whether in this state or any state or the federal courts, reversed a speedy trial on a speedy trial violation ground after a 7-day delay?
No, the answer to that is no, although that we did not spend a considerable amount of time looking at that issue, only the issue that was in dispute. And that particular issue was whether or not this meets the fourth test of the Barco-Ringo factor, whether the delay prejudiced the defendant. And I note for this that there is that strong presumption that once the 60-day is triggered, which is not in dispute in this case, then that becomes the issue. The other Barker-Wingo tests were met, and that's not in dispute.
Can we look at that factor? I was
Yes.
a little confused in your brief as to what the prejudice was to your client. You mentioned that, I think, that the pretrial incarceration outside of this particular location close to the court in the county where he was to be tried was onerous in this case.
Well, Your Honor.
I didn't see you explain how so. Can you explain how it was onerous in this case?
Well, first of all, he had already spent 10 months, and I suppose your question is how does his next seven days make it onerous? Well, I would like to go further and go back to the court's benefit to the argument that the trial counsel made. And essentially, the trial counsel made that Mr. Muzi was prejudice because of the witnesses that the prosecutor was able to secure for the trial during that 1 week delay. And
well, I'm looking at the argument that you made on a brief on appeal. We're limited to that at this point. If that argument wasn't made on appeal, that was the basis for prejudice, I'm focusing on the argument that was made in the brief by Mr. Musi on appeal, which asserts the onerousness. And I'm
right,
trying to get a sense of what
the argument made
is.
In the brief was twofold, Your Honor. First of all, that extra 7 days after 10 months, after Mr. Musi insisted on a speedy trial, is in fact onerous, that any extra time in jail becomes onerous.
How so?
Because it's more time in incarcerated. Your liberty is taken away from you, and you are not, you're stuck in jail.
Wasn't there a warrant elsewhere that would have resulted in his incarceration? There was another warrant in Scott County or somewhere, wasn't there?
Yes, although he would have been out on that warrant, Your Honor, as I understand the facts.
He would have been out on it?
Yes, that he would have then sought bail and been able to be released, as I understand the facts.
Is there something in the record that supports that impression?
Something in the transcript, as I understand the transcript, Your Honor.
And what would that be?
I don't have the cite. Okay. It was part of the argument presented to the judge by trial counsel. So I'd like to, with court's permission, move to the second argument. Hassan Musi did not have effective legal representation, and had he had effective legal representation, the verdict would have been different, not guilty, and that this met the Strickland test. And we raised 3 points to that argument. The first is that Hassan Musi's counsel allowed leading questions by the prosecutor throughout the trial while very rarely making leading question objections. As reflected at page 16, line 9 of the transcript, the prosecutor's tone of the questioning was set. As the prosecutor was then questioning the state's main witness, the victim, Abdallah, was the main witness, a key witness in this case. And here's what the prosecutor said. So we're just going to try to do yeses or nos. Is that fair? Asking the main witness, victim in the case. And then he began asking leading questions. And then when Mr. Abdallah didn't answer one question, yes or no, as reflected at page 25, line 3, the prosecutor affirmed to the Mr. Abdallah again, asking leading questions, say again, try to do these in yeses and nos. And again, the prosecutor was putting his main case in, identifying the witness through all leading questions, and it wasn't until much later the trial counsel finally objected to leading question, and it was sustained. And then the prosecutor went back to asking leading questions all the way till the trial counsel again objected to the leading question.
Can you think of any strategic reason why a defense attorney might welcome leading questions?
Right? Not in this case, Your Honor, because it was all about identifying the putting words. Essentially, it was a prosecutor testifying to the jury, putting directly telling the jury what he wanted Mr. Abdallah to say, and then Mr. Abdallah would say yes. And so, no, there was no strategic reason in this case for that. It just went on and on and on, and essentially the whole case in chief, the most important witness, never testified other than really to yes or no, and the prosecutor essentially got to put his whole case in by asking those leading questions. And it's our position that the trial counsel should have approached the bench and asked the court to order the prosecutor not to continue to do it, because, of course, objecting to every leading question in front of the...
What would you say is the most difficult or damaging testimony that came out of those leading questions?
Saying he could identify Mr. Musi walking up, even though he was sitting in the back seat and shouldn't have, and it was dark and shouldn't have been able to see him, he said he could identify him.
That's what I thought. But wasn't there other evidence that was introduced or that would have been introduced demonstrating that this witness had already identified Mr. Musi as the shooter?
Not in this case. Not Not, you mean separate from Mr. Abdallah's testimony? Are you talking about a different witness?
Prior testimony. Was there not? Was there a prior statement given by this
witness? Enforcement? I don't know that, Your Honor. So anyway, that's we believe that alone meets the Strickland test, that this deviated from the standard of acceptable professional conduct and would change, could potentially, likely, very likely change the outcome of the case. But in addition to that, there were two other points we made, and one was violation of the confrontation clause, and this last one was failure to object to the court's denial on the theory that he was allowed to ask the question of Mr. Abdallah that he was shot before. And it wasn't.
That confrontation clause question was a curious one to me, because this was an unusual case where you actually have on the record the defense attorney, trial attorney, saying, I really think this is a bad way to go. I've advised my client accordingly. And then Mr. Musi had the opportunity and put on the record his desire is to waive the confrontation clause right. So whose right is it? Is it the lawyer's right, or is it the defendant's right?
It's the defendant's right, Your Honor, and perhaps we overstated that issue.
So what's the procedure? I'm trying to get a sense of what would the court's authority have been at that point when an attorney essentially wants to assert a right that the defendant wants to waive. What is the court supposed to do at that point?
Look at whether the defendant knowingly waived that right.
Did the district court do that in this case?
It depends on how the court would look at it. The judge, of course, said that the prosecutor had a motion to show that maybe there was some violence directed at by friends or something towards a particular witness, and the judge essentially said, if I find that, then I'm going to allow four statements in instead of two statements. And then after discussion, according to the way I read the transcript, Mr. Musi decided, based on that, to allow those two.
So what should the district court have done at that moment?
I have no answer for that, Your Honor.
With the benefit of hindsight, it seems like if you think about it at that moment in time, it doesn't seem like Mr. Musi's decision suggests like it was a completely unreasonable decision, because there were two statements from this witness that were inconsistent with each other, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And so if some of it's possibly going to come in, it seems like that might have not only been an okay decision, it might have been the smartest thing to do at that point, to say, well, by golly, if there's going to be some of it come in, I just assume the whole works came in and we can argue about it, because this other witness is making statements that are inconsistent with one another.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to move to what I think is a very key argument, and that's whether or not the tape should have been allowed to be replayed to the jury.
The tape of that same witness.
Correct. And just cutting to the chase, I want to first note for the court that the judge initially denied that tape to come in, and if you look at page 47, lines 12 through 16, the judge said...
47 of what?
Of...
trial transcript?
Correct.
Okay.
Lines 12. And the judge said, this is replacing the testimony of a witness. We didn't. We're not letting all other witnesses testify. And this is where the judge initially decided not to do it, that it would be prejudicial. And then he further, the next page, on page 48, lines 1 through 10, it's not like a 911 call. It replaces testimony. I think it unfairly highlights his testimony in as opposed to all the other testimony of the witnesses. And when the judge was thinking about it later, he as to the three-factor test, when he got to the third factor, and that's improper use by the jury to hear this tape, he just said, well, I don't know what that means. And what I think it means is it means just what he said in the beginning, that it would be the jury would unfairly consider that testimony. And again, this was not testimony under oath sworn and subject to cross-examination. So I believe that it was an abuse of discretion, and it's our position that it could have changed the outcome of the trial. Well, and part of the reasoning the judge gave, the trial judge gave, is, well, maybe they couldn't hear the tape.
Your client wanted these tapes in because your client believed there was information in these tapes that would help your client's case. So if that's so, and it's not unreasonable, to why wouldn't it just be as likely that the jury was interested in hearing these tapes to support your client as opposed to oppose your client's position?
Well, and the reason I don't totally agree with that, Your Honor, is that, again, it was in the face of the judge saying that if there was intimidation by people that Musi didn't know to Hassan or to Muhammad Qari, then he was going to let four tapes in. So it wasn't some voluntary thing. It was kind of under threat that if I decide against you, I'm going to let four tapes in, two tapes, one to the prosecutor and one to law enforcement, that Mr. Carey was afraid. So it wasn't.
That's going back to the original Confrontation Clause issue. I'm talking about the issue you're raising now, or you're arguing about now, which is the letting the jury hear the tape a second time. So why wouldn't, once it's in, why wouldn't allowing the jury to hear the tape be just as likely supportive of your client's theory as the state's theory of the case, given your client's desire?
Can I continue, Your Honor?
You can answer the question, yes.
Because, again, I don't see that it was, first of all, the judge, just like the judge, he thought it would highlight the testimony. And obviously, highlighting it is that there was negative testimony as well. And therefore, the trial judge initially was worried that that's what would happen, that it would be prejudicial because it would highlight that. And you can't say that it was equal to both sides. We don't know that.
Thank you, Mr.
And
Crawford.
That was not a reason that the judge gave to submit it. Thank you.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes of more time if you'd like to use it for a rebuttal. Counsel for the state.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Patrick Lofton for the state of Minnesota. This court should affirm appellant's convictions in this case. Obviously, appellant raised a number of issues. I think some of them are worth more discussion than others. So I'm going to go straight to the Confrontation Clause issue, if that's okay with your honors. I can answer any questions about speedy trial or leading questions if you have those. But on the Confrontation Clause, this court should hold that a defendant can validly waive their Confrontation Clause rights if they're done so knowingly and voluntarily, and especially when there's a clear strategic reason, as in this case, to do that. And I think it's interesting the
question. Why would it matter?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why would it matter whether there's a clear strategic reason if a defendant knowingly waives his rights?
I guess it wouldn't matter, but it makes it much clearer in this case that it was knowing and voluntary. In other words, if there's a reason to do it that makes sense strategically, then we know we're not faced with a criminal defendant who's not understanding the procedure against him, who's not making a completely irrational choice, at which point you'd have a tougher issue. But here, as Your Honor pointed out, there was a reason the defendant might want the jury to hear both of those interviews, and so therefore we know that that waiver was knowing and voluntary, or was, at least, sorry.
Was there enough of a record made to, well, rephrase my question a bit. The district court could have made a more clear, had a more clear colloquy with Mr. Musi, establishing that he really understood the right that he was waiving.
I do agree that the exchange gets a little muddy there at times in certain parts of the transcript, but I think the key factors were acknowledged by him. He could have a hearing, excuse me. He could have a hearing on whether there had been forfeiture by wrongdoing. He understood that. He understood that it was his absolute right to have MK come in and testify, that he had an absolute right to confront him, that this stuff wasn't coming in unless he agreed to it. And that waiver was further solidified after the introduction of that evidence as well. So I think there's enough there to find that he validly did that. And In terms of whether this right is personal to the defendant, I think it is. I think it's just like the right to testify. It's a constitutional right. The lawyer doesn't get to choose whether the defendant asserts it or not. I think, as I said in my brief, if the reverse had happened, we'd be having a completely different discussion right now. There have been countless trials, surely, where a lawyer has told his client, you do not need to get up there and testify. They're going to destroy you if you do that. But nonetheless, that defendant has asserted that Fifth Amendment right and done so. And here, he chose to waive that Sixth Amendment right. And I think that's clear from the record. I'm going to move on now to the alternative perpetrator issue, if that's okay.
Well, let me ask one question about the leading questions.
Yes.
Issue. It does seem like in the very early going, there is a statement by the trial prosecutor. I'm going to ask all leading questions here. Is that all right with everybody? Doesn't that seem like that would have been a good point for the district court to maybe call a timeout and say, hold on here, is there a reason? I mean, it doesn't seem like it was a language problem. He's the witness seemingly is able to respond in English. There's no translator there. Seems like that might have been a good place to call timeout and say, does Mr. Musi know that there's an objection for leading questions?
And there doesn't, by the way, seem also to be a hostility issue.
Right.
The witness was not established as a hostile witness at that point, or I think any point.
You're right. There's no record on that. A further record on those issues would have been ideal. Either A, did the victim have some sorts of disabilities that made him unable to kind of do an exchange? Was he fearful of the defendant?
Which, by the way, you can't. I didn't sense any of that from the transcript, that there was any difficulty conversing.
I didn't either, Your Honor, and there was no record made as to fear of the defendant. I think that's part of the issue, but I have to concede there's nothing in the record about fear from the defendant. Perhaps this court can infer that from the fact that he believes this man shot him six times. But other than that, there is nothing in the record as to why there was so much leading. And there was a lot of leading. There definitely was.
With an announcement that it was about to start.
Right. And again, the record is silent as to why the prosecutor chose to do that. But what we do know from the record is that the defense attorney knew a leading question when he saw one, and he objected when he decided it was appropriate to. As Judge Ross was asking, I believe that there is a strategic reason to allow lots of leading of a witness. It impugns their credibility. It's something you can point out to the jury later, as he certainly did. And so defense counsel objected when he thought was appropriate. Personally, my read of this transcript is that the trial lawyer did a great job in this case, all around, the defense attorney, that is. And I don't think that him waiting until halfway through the victim's testimony falls below an objective standard of reasonableness for purposes of ineffective assistance of counsel. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank
okay.
you.
Thank you. The alternative perpetrator issue here, I think, presents a pretty unique set of facts as well. I did cite for Your Honor's cases that note that when an alternative perpetrator is not a specifically identified person, you still have to go through that analysis, but here, I think it's even stronger because what they're essentially getting into is reverse Spriegel. And although, or tried to get into, was reverse Spriegel. Not reverse Spriegel of a third party, but of the victim himself, which would fall under the regular rules of Minnesota Rule of Evidence 404B, just as if it were the defendant, that you have to do a Spriegel analysis before you get into those prior bad acts. And again, getting shot is not necessarily a prior bad act, although I think in the context of this sort of gang-type case it is, but it is certainly a prior act.
This wasn't argued as a Spriegel issue to the district court, was it?
It was not. It was argued as alternative perpetrator.
Right. By name, right?
Yes. And that's how the defense attorney characterized it.
And the prosecutor responded to it not by raising a Spriegel issue, but directly responding to the alternative perpetrator theory.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why would we look at Spriegel at this point?
Because within all of the alternative perpetrator case law, Flores, Nasaki, there's others I can't come up with right off the top of my head, what the second prong of alternative perpetrator analysis usually goes to is whether the prior bad acts of that alternative perpetrator then come into evidence to prove that they had done something in the past that indicates that they're the ones who would have committed this. And here, that then shifted to the victim because the defense attorney tried to imply, hey, you've been shot before, someone else might want to shoot you now. And the thing about that is...
Was there any more detail than that?
No, Your Honor.
Was there any, out of the presence of the jury discussion about who it was and why it was?
No, Your Honor. And whether the prosecutor and defense attorney files had police reports related to that shooting, I can't speak to.
Not in our record.
It's not in our record.
And there was no offer of proof.
No offer of proof. I mean, it could have been a hunting accident for all we know. I mean, I doubt it, Your Honor, but, you know, for all we know, it could have been a domestic assault of some sort. We don't know what sort of shooting it was. And without some sort of proffer as to how that relates to the crime scene at issue, that's simply inadmissible.
The proffer would really sort of have to include some action on the part, I think, of the person who was shot to bring it about. In other words, if they were an innocent bystander somewhere and got shot, that wouldn't be admissible. You'd have to somehow say that other shooting was caused by something that this person was doing bad or wrong.
I think I agree with that.
Yeah.
Yes.
He somehow contributed to his own shooting.
Right. That he has enemies on the street, as the defense attorney put it, in the record. I was about to say something else about the being shot. I lost my train of thought on that. The whole point, though, is that you have to have an inherent tendency to connect a person to the... that's what I was going to say. There's nothing in the record either that defense was seeking discovery on this issue. So, in other words, whatever it was that had led to the victim being shot before, it seems like the parties clearly knew. Otherwise, I don't know how the defense attorney would have known to ask that question. But there's nothing in the record that the defense attorney had sought additional discovery to try and connect this crime scene to that. And so I think that lays a lot of groundwork for showing that there was no connection to that prior shooting to this crime scene. At this point, I don't have any sort of affirmative arguments to make, but I'm happy to answer any other questions about any of these issues. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel for Mr. Musi, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd just like to point out a couple things. My co-counsel, Gary Wolf, while it's not directly relevant, has handled over 50 murder cases, tried many. He sees this issue as the issue of being able to allow trial counsel to ask the question about, have you been shot before, and not have to produce that the alternative perpetrator theory by setting foundation that there was some particular person as going to reasonable doubt. And he sees that issue, as we presented in our brief.
Well, let's assume that's so. On appeal, in an argument of ineffective assistance of counsel, the burden is on your client, Mr. Musi, to show prejudice. And we have to look to the record to see whether the prevention of this evidence was prejudicial to your client. Does the record tell us whether the victim's prior shooter is still alive or was still alive at the time of the shooting in this case?
No, Your Honor.
Does it tell us when the prior shooting occurred?
No, Your Honor.
Or where it occurred?
No, Your Honor.
Or how it occurred? Circumstances?
No, Your Honor.
So how does your client at this point then establish that the lack of this evidence prejudices his defense? The outcome would have been different.
Well, first of all, we say that trial counsel should have framed the issue and made that an appealable issue, which the trial counsel did not. Trial counsel just went along with the judge when the judge said, well, that's just speculation, and you don't meet the foundation of the alternative perpetrator theory, and then counsel didn't. So we've raised that as an ineffective assistance of counsel argument as well as part of our brief. But separate from that, we still see it, even without those facts, as showing that the implication is he could have other enemies out there on the street.
Right, but what's the... Not if his prior shooter is no longer alive. Not if he was shot in a hunting accident or he was or in a domestic abuse situation. I mean, we don't know those things. So Don't we need to know those things to know how the evidence might have impacted the jury's analysis as to who the shooter was?
I would say no to that, Your Honor, and that would be closing argument for the prosecutor to point out that.
Maybe in trial, but now on appeal, what's the logical hook for us to conclude, as you're arguing, that this prejudiced your client, that the lack of this evidence, that having this evidence would have helped your client at trial? How do we know that? That the outcome would have been different?
Well, it's like leading questions, Your Honor. I can't say with certainty. I think it's very likely. It's another factor, but without a crystal ball, I can't say with certainty.
Let me redirect on the same topic. Why, if the record doesn't contain this information, and it's hard for Judge Ross to find a hook, why wasn't this raised by a petition for post-conviction relief where you could have supplemented the record or at least requested that opportunity to say, here's why it would have made a difference?
I don't have an answer for that, Your Honor. Any questions of the court?
I have none.
I think there are no more questions from us.
Thank you so much for the court to listen.
Thank you, sir, and thank you both for your argument and your briefing in this matter. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you.
Thank you.